she had no knowledge of what he was talking about. But think about it. This is Ronald Reagan's Secretary of the Navy, now member of the 9/11 Commission, saying to the National Security Advisor, are you aware of the fact that we had this policy and still have this policy that if you select more than a certain number of individuals of a particular ethnic stripe out of line at any one time, that's discriminatory in the eyes of our government? I heard him ask the question, and of course, I reflect on my own experience because I couldn't for the life of me understand how my 8-year-old son has been singled out for this random screening on the flight down to Florida and then coming back. So I then sought out John Layman to ask him, because Condoleezza Rice hadn't offered much in her response, what in the world was he talking about? I remember the day so well because the gentleman who's running the audio for me and runs all the engineering aspects of the morning program is Pete Nelson. Pete, by the way, thank you very much for playing that role again here tonight.
Shut the hell up, you babbling right-wing demagogue. Don't talk about some kind of quota system that's happening for certain people being not picked out of line when under your whole war on drugs crusade, cats from the likes of Bill Russell to Joel Morgan to LeVar Burton have all been picked out of line, out of line in airports, out of lines, trying to get gas, just walking down the street. That's your Nazified form of selective engagement. So don't play all of a sudden shocked that some people have called the task this type of racial profiling, all based in your 3-3-2-2 concept. Well, here's a concept that we have in response. A slave revolt response. Check it out. Listening to 104.1, 106.7 Illinois, 101.1 Santa Cruz, LUVER.com, the world, radioforall.net, the universe, and Google into your slave revolt radio on your Google web and check out what's going on in the blog sphere. Find out what time it is. Tonight, we're about to find out what time it is concerning the HIV/AIDS controversy, an interview with Professor Peter Duisberg. That's what we got. That's how we're coming. So we got all that and more on 104.1 Slave Revolt.
Hello, seekers. Here we go again. And hello, especially to the skeptic inside you who might still believe, 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 believe.
tonight, we're about to go into a Ruins of Empire interview with Professor Duesberg, one of the leading molecular retroviruses professors at the University of Berkeley. And we're going to take on and examine this HIV-AIDS hypothesis and deal with it as it lurks within the whole corporate media spectrum and the corporations that help finance the virus hunters, so to speak. So, first off, how you doing, Professor?
What? As usual. Always you, Tracy.
All right, let's get started. You know, in 1981, the CDC first recorded an increase of 12 previously known diseases. This list is now up to 30 previously known diseases that HIV, if you have HIV, is supposed to be the cause of. In other words, first they came out with a few around 12 and said that if you have HIV and one of those 12 diseases, you have what they considered AIDS. Now it's increased up to 30 previously known diseases, one of those and HIV, and you have what is classified as AIDS. Now, what's kind of interesting in this also is that AIDS, as we know, is the acquired immune deficiency syndrome. Yet the AIDS diseases fall into two categories. One is the immunodeficient diseases, which 74% of that 30 fall into, you know, tuberculosis, herpes virus, pneumonia, things like, et cetera, et cetera. But non-immunodeficiency diseases are now included in that list. 26% of the 30. Dementia, Kaposi, sarcoma, leukemia. So my first question is how is HIV causing non-immune deficient diseases, since HIV is supposed to break down your immune system and you are supposed to die of an immune deficient disease?
Well, the answer is they have studied that now for 21 years for $110 billion from the taxpayer alone, but we still don't know how. They keep saying we have to look at it further. It's such a difficult virus to understand. Well, in other words, the problem is this virus probably causes none of these diseases, and it's just has been named that way erroneously 21 years ago, and this has been endorsed, unfortunately, by the government before it was even published, and now we are stuck with a politically fixed explanation that is very difficult to get out of. But there isn't a virus like HIV. It would be among viruses the Jesus Christ or the Arnold Schwarzenegger, among viruses that could do much more than any virus we have ever heard of has ever done. Yet the problem is it doesn't infect doctors, it doesn't infect scientists, it doesn't hurt prostitutes, and the wives of hemophiliacs who are HIV positive don't get AIDS from it either. It's a very selective virus. It only likes male homosexuals, in this country at least, and intravenous drug users, and it doesn't care about heterosexuals at all. We have 4.5 million babies per year, and it's supposed to be a sexually transmitted virus,
right,
and heterosexuals don't get AIDS, not in 21 years from it. So they have unprotected sex, otherwise we wouldn't have those 4.5 million babies, but no AIDS outside the risk group.
Now, does HIV cause any new diseases? You know, generally speaking, an infectious disease or virus would cause a specific type of disease. Does are any of these out of the 30 a new disease that had not been on the scene before?
Not one of them is. That's another cause of concern, making you very suspicious. How come this virus is copying other microbes or other causes of diseases like tuberculosis or dementia of weight loss when you don't get anything to eat, when all other viruses that cause diseases cause a very specific one. Flu causes pneumonia and not dementia and not diarrhea. And hepatitis virus causes liver disease and not T-cell or immune deficiency and not Kaposi sarcoma. And measles causing what we call measles and yellow fever, and so on. They have their names for the diseases they cause. Their genetic repertoire is very, very limited indeed. They have the lowest IQ in biology you could possibly have.
But generally speaking, when one is looking at an infectious disease, there is a standard, scientific standard. It's called Koch postulates to follow to make sure that it is an infectious disease as opposed to some other symptom that's coming down. How does HIV/AIDS stand up to Koch postulates?
This is the gold standard to determine whether a microbial suspect of a disease or a viral suspect is indeed its cause. And this is what you should have, or we should have met before we prescribe antiviral medications that are as toxic as the ones we are using, AZT and others. Before we use those, we should have met Koch postulates. And Koch postulates are nothing else but old-fashioned logic. Koch said, when he had discovered that tuberculosis was caused by a bacterium, that was the first disease that was shown to be caused by a microbe, that Nobel Prize became immensely popular to this very day, and they had dozens and dozens of imitators. People wanted to be like Koch, find the cause of colon cancer, and find the cause of pneumonia, and find the cause of aging, and all these things, and said, oh, I found a microbe for this and for that. And Koch said, very nice, but in order to prove that this is indeed the cause, you have to meet three criteria. And the first one of these is, it should be always present in your disease. So, if it's polio, we should find polio virus there in every single case. But if you think tennis elbows are caused by a virus, you should find a virus in every single tennis elbow you diagnose. And second, he said, once we have a correlation, that's not enough yet to prove it, because everybody of us carries pneumocystis, carries yeast, and carries E. coli. And yet, we don't get sick from these things. So, you have to do one more thing. You have to isolate it away from many other microbes and show me this virus or microbe alone can cause a disease, either in a susceptible animal, or in a volunteer or accidentally infected human. Once that is done, then you have a case, my friend. And that has been done with virtually with all microbial diseases that we know today. We know that poliovirus is the cause of polio. We know that herpes virus is the cause of herpes. We know that pneumococcal can be the cause of pneumonia, and so on. And we know that spirochetes are the cause of syphilis, and so on. But for HIV, we have not even met the correlation pool. We have pneumonia, we have weight loss, we have dementia, we have Kaposi sarcoma, all in the absence of this virus. We have been trying for 21 years to use the isolated virus. We have met that criterion with great difficulties and great expenses. It's difficult to isolate. We inoculated into chimpanzees. None of them ever got AIDS. Not one. And look at this. This virus is said to be the cause of AIDS. In America, we have the best documented statistics on it. Since the beginning of AIDS, 21 years ago, roughly since HIV AIDS, we have in America 929,000 AIDS patients. All of them have been treated or are still treated in hospitals by doctors and healthcare workers. And despite the enormous efforts, we don't have a vaccine to protect these doctors. They are virtually in the front lines fighting against this deadly virus. treating AIDS patients. And guess how many of these doctors or healthcare workers who have seen 921,000 patients dying or sick from the virus in the hospitals, injecting them, treating them, washing them, operating them, and burying them, have contracted AIDS from their patients?
How many?
I have never found one, not even one case report, which is what most doctors love to write, a case report. Here's my heterosexual doctor from Walnut Creek, seeing AIDS patients in the San Francisco General Hospital. Now he comes home, tells his wife and kids, sorry, we have to see about refinancing the house. I have Kaposi sarcoma from a patient. In 2 years, I'm gone.
Not one
in JAMA, not one in Science, not one in Nature, not one in the prestigious New England Journal of Medicine. Nowhere in the computers I've ever found even one little description. Here's the doctor, here's the patient, a needle stick, and now I have Kaposi sarcoma. Not once.
But that goes into some other things. Arthur Ashe was supposed to have contracted HIV through a blood transfusion during an operation. It was unbeknownst to him at the time, and then he proceeded to have unprotected sex with his wife over and over and actually conceived of a baby while he was supposedly had the HIV antibodies in his system. Mm-hmm. And he was doing quite well until he found out he had quote-unquote HIV, and then was convinced to use AZT. Mm-hmm. And at that point, it seemed to be a Reva Virchi. But at the same time, both his wife and his daughter seemed to be healthy and fine. How do you explain that? Since one of the ways that you can, quote unquote, transmit the AIDS virus is through unprotected sex, according to the orthodox.
If you can't transmit it in a 10-year marriage to a kid or wife, it doesn't look good from a virus point of view for its survival. I'm a virologist. See, a virus has to make sure it can move from one host to the next in order to survive.
Be opportunistic.
It has to find a new host or else it will be eliminated in evolution. If it can propagate or replicate by going from one to the next, it's going to be checked out very fast. Evolution is a very competitive business. If it can't make it as a sexually transmitted virus in a 10-year marriage that has produced a kid, that looks very bad for this virus as a survivor. So what is it that Arthur Ashe got? As you said yourself, once he was identified as HIV antibody positive, he was scared or intimidated by his doctors to take antiviral therapy. And what is antiviral therapy? It is chemotherapy developed 40 years ago. The mainstay of it is called ACT. It's a building block of DNA. It's a fake building block of DNA. And those building blocks of DNA have two arms, stretched out like this. They hold on to each other to build these huge chains of molecules that are called DNA, or chromosomes, or genetic material. And now to kill cancer cells, we developed fake building blocks that have only one arm. So the cell doesn't notice that this guy has only one arm, puts it in the chain, and guess what makes? It terminates the chain, because there's not a second arm to stretch out to the next nucleotide for the molecule to go to its destined length. So the cell is going to die, and with it, sooner or later, the whole guy is going to die. Because you can support or survive cell death only for so long.
So it puts a caboose on your DNA replication. Your DNA replication goes ACGT, ACGT, repeats. This stops its replication, and by that causes an immune deficiency breakdown.
Immune deficiency, weight loss, and you get diarrhea, you get liver diseases, dementia, your muscles get weak. Remember Nureyev? He was only two, the famous Russian ballet star. Mm-hmm. At 54, he couldn't stand up anymore. Or Randy Shields, who wrote the book, that most successful AIDS book ever. The man played on. He was HIV positive, believed in his own dogma, and took ACT at the age of something in the 30s. A millionaire now, with a farm in the Russian River, down there, that he had bought for a million. He could only sit on the sofa and receive his ovations for that movie he wrote.
That goes into a couple other things. You know, AZT was developed as a cancer treatment drug in 1960 by Jerome Horowitz. And at that time, it was known as Compound S, but it was so toxic that they shelved it. But when the quote-unquote AIDS scare came in, they unshelved it, changed the name, waved a wand to the FDA, and like many of these other drugs that are hammering people to death, it suddenly emerged out on the market. Is that how basically AZT was able to come back from the dead?
Yeah, it is like, it's roughly as you say, almost exactly as you say. See, the companies develop a lot of so-called analogs, variants that have in the same effect. They all terminate DNA synthesis. They are terminators, like Arnold Schwarzenegger. So, but it costs a lot of money, millions literally, to get Food and Drug Administration, FDA approval. You have to go through clinical trials, which are immensely expensive for the drug companies. One has to say that. They have to lubricate the patients and the doctors and pay for the drugs and pay for the files. It's millions and millions. So they always take a few from the repertoire of drugs they have and push them through the licensing process, to the getting ready for the licensing process for the clinical trials, which cost millions, and a lot are left on the shelf. And AZT was one of those leftovers on the shelf that they could now place on the market when there was this demand: how could we kill that deadly virus? Now that we had accepted the hypothesis that this is the cause of AIDS, anything would go, even the most toxic type of medicine drug that medicine has ever come up with, namely DNA chain terminators, because according to that theory, hypothesis, HIV was even worse than cancer.
Well, concerning the whole HIV theory and stuff, it's not like they're testing for active per se a viral symptoms and stuff. Is it not true that they're testing for the antibodies themselves?
Well, Tracy, they are testing for the virus, and they have tried it very hard, but they can't find it. By the time they look, and long before a disease ever occurs, that virus is long gone, has been neutralized by the immune system, by your own immune system. It has been what we call an asymptomatic infection, an infection by a virus that doesn't cause a disease, and what's left over is only antibody against it. So by the time you have antibody, it's very hard to find a virus. Even Dr. Gallo, the nation's leading AIDS researcher, as he used to be called in the press, not so much anymore since he was caught misappropriating the virus from the French sources, but he used to be, he couldn't find it. And that may be a choosy scandal for scandal experts, but it actually served a useful purpose in showing what AIDS or HIV really is. Gallo would have found the virus had it been present at concentrations that cause a disease. You know, when viruses cause a disease, they're abundant. They're oozing around or cruising around in the organs where they cause the disease. So if it has been a T-cell virus or blood virus, the blood would be loaded with it. It would be easy to find. And Gallo would have found it. He's not that bad. We were old friends. You know, not so much anymore, but we used to be. And I know he's not that bad. He's not Albert Einstein of virology, but he's not bad. He would have found it. And he couldn't find it because it was gone. But he had no other idea, but he had already offered this idea, and he had already...
In a press conference. Committed,
already a press conference. There's no way back. Now he had to do something. So he got it from a friend and said, now I got it finally. Here it is.
Well, HIV is a retrovirus. And there are many of retroviruses.
Good point, yeah.
And retroviruses are commonly known as passenger virus. If this HIV is the virus that is basically the one that puts you in your coffin, how often do retroviruses cause this type of effect, or what other type of retroviruses kill people?
Yes, why, this is a very difficult question, because there's not one single case retrovirus known that has ever caused the disease outside the laboratory or artificial breeding colonies of animals and things like that. Nothing. It has never been found in a wild animal or in humans, or in fact the equivalent of wild animals. No, I mean genetically, since they're crossbred, not bred in farms.
Right.
They behave like this and act like this. So we have never seen a retrovirus ever causing a disease outside the laboratory. And it is for that reason that most of these viruses have only been discovered recently, because we didn't have the tools to find a virus that does do know nothing, as we say. Because when they don't do anything, they're hiding, they're inactive, and they're very difficult to detect. You need very sophisticated probes or equipment to find a latent virus. It's like looking for a needle in the haystack.
Now, generally speaking, on infectious diseases, usually it's a split pretty evenly amongst the sexes. In other words, it doesn't discriminate between black, white, male, female. Right down the line, being an opportunistic disease, it's going to split between the female and the male population. How does the HIV/AIDS hypothesis, if it's an infectious disease, work percentage-wise between the male and female population?
Well, here, what you're saying now is the start of a classical distinction between a microbial or viral epidemic and a chemical or lifestyle epidemic. All microbial and viral epidemics in the history, without exception, are random in the population, just as you say. Boys and girls, homosexuals, heterosexuals, all alike, any races, they're not that picky. They take what they can get. The difference is the chemical evidence. Take, for example, lung cancer from smoking. That is almost 100%, or over 90% restricted to smokers. Or liver cirrhosis is found in alcoholics. And it's not contagious compared to what AIDS is said to be, but real infectious diseases are contagious and lifestyle diseases are not, and they're not random. So AIDS, we already covered the problem with contagiousness. Doctors don't get it, scientists don't get it, prostitutes don't get it. And in the population, only two risk groups are really the major players here, and those are the intravenous drug users and a very small subset of male homosexuals.
So basically what you're saying is that this is chemically induced, in the same way that if you smoke two packs of cigarettes a day for 20 years, don't be surprised if you get cancer. By the same token, people who use certain types of recreational drugs, poppers, more commonly known as aminonitrates, cocaine, heroin, these are within themselves immune depressant drugs, even though they're recreational drugs, and they wreak havoc on your T cell, causing immune system types of breakdowns just using the drugs alone. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly that. Plus, let's say the Kaposi sarcoma, which is almost exclusively restricted to male homosexuals who used regularly the nitride inhalants or poppers, which are giving a psychoactive drug that is an alkylating and mutating agent that facilitates anal sex and gives you a high at the same time, very cheap, but at the long run it gives you cancer. And this is exactly where it's segregating in the population. It's only with the male homosexuals. the intravenous drug users who use other drugs like heroin, cocaine primarily, or the transfusion recipients and minority of AIDS patients, or other transfusion recipients never get Kaposi sarcoma. In fact, 3 million Americans on average get a transfusion per year. Not once have we ever recorded, not even once, a Kaposi sarcoma in a transfusion recipient from this deadly virus.
Now let's go over like some of the kind of misconceptions people have when they hear these numbers thrown around. Because like when AIDS is talked about, it's talked about in kind of often a global sense. And Africa is often thrown into the picture as a way of saying, look how catastrophic it is. But it appears that there's another standard for evaluating if someone has quote-unquote AIDS in Africa as opposed to America and Europe. In Africa, it's under what is called the Bankwe definition. And the Bankwe definition is if you have 10% of weight loss within a 2 months period of time, dry cough, diarrhea,
tuberculosis.
So if you have these types of basically symptoms, you can be diagnosed as having AIDS without even an HIV test included for the antibodies. Where in America, it goes by a whole nother script where it has, as I mentioned at the start of the show, if you test positive for the HIV antibodies and have one or of 30 diseases, then you can be diagnosed as being an AIDS patient. So, this seems to help the confusion, doesn't it, as far as how AIDS is looked at when they just have these large numbers. And since there's supposed to be, I guess, an AIDS strain in Africa that's different than America and in Europe, which is why I guess they're hypothesizing people are coming down with different types of symptoms, why hasn't that strain in Africa ever hit these shores? So that people would come down with that narrow category of a strain, and have they isolated this particular strain that says this is the African strain and this is the symptoms you will come down with, and here's the American and European one and this is the symptoms you'll come down with?
All efforts that they have made to distinguish, quote, the African strain from the non-African strain have failed to show a difference, a consistent difference. They use the same tests, the same antibody tests, which means we are looking at exactly the same virus in Africa, in Europe, and in America. If they use it, you correctly pointed out, the convention is in Africa, we don't do the test because it's too expensive. A test costs a minimum of $25 to $50, which is 3 times more than the average health spending per person in sub-Saharan Africa. 3 times more per year. They spend about $8 to $10 per year on health, so they cannot afford the AIDS test. So they use a presumptive diagnosis. Now, you're also pointing out a very critical fact here, that AIDS in Africa is not in risk groups, it's in the general population. How can the same virus be random in the population, meaning heterosexual, if you like that word, and practically homosexual in this country, where it's only with boys, male homosexuals, and intravenous drug users, almost exclusively, except a few chunky women? It's the same virus. That can't be true, but we never talk about that either in the AIDS establishment. They say it's a cofactor. Whatever that cofactor is, I've never heard the answer. Well, I think the cofactor is very simply a different chemical cause, a very old one in Africa, namely malnutrition, parasitic infection, lack of drinkable water, and no sanitation or very poor sanitation. The same river is the sewer, the source of water, the dishwasher, and the bathtub.
Right, so what you're basically saying is that the poor economic and health standards that exist in many parts of Africa, which, you know, unsanitary water, so on and so forth, helps bring about these various diseases that are being diagnosed as having, for the people as having AIDS. Yet, it really has to do with the health standards and conditions that the people are living in.
And look what they are. They have just renamed all diseases. It's weight loss, it's diarrhea, and tuberculosis. That's exactly what you get when you have nothing to eat or not adequate nutrition.
Right.
You don't have any proteins and no vitamins and have no water.
Well, let's hear some of the people who often are within the Orthodox and are paraders of the line of the HIV hive.
I bet
AIDS
they're
hypothesis.
Jamming the phone lines, calling in. Anthony Fauci.
Here,
Paul Wolverding.
Well, first let's start off with Ira Flatow. He's the host of an NPR show called Science Friday.
Is he on the phone right now?
No. He's not that bold. Anyway, he has on some AIDS specialists who talk about the spread and how it may spread and how your genetic makeup may help block the infection of HIV. This is the, you know, the CCR5 receptor and on and on. So let's hear what Flatow and company has to say, and then let's check out what you have to say. Dig this.
Flatow and Socrates,
A couple of studies.
I'm Socrates.
Studies out this week about how AIDS may spread and how it might be influenced by your genetic makeup. You know, we hear about the genes being important, all kinds of diseases. We're just finally learning now about how your gene makeup may be important in the spread of HIV and your an infection. Researchers have known since the mid-90s that people with certain genes are far less likely to become infected with HIV if they're exposed to the virus. HIV enters cells through a receptor, a sort of a gateway called CCR5. We each have two copies of the CCR5 gene, one from each of our parents. And people with two mutated or defective copies of the gene have almost complete resistance to HIV. Interesting research point here. Mm-hmm. And last week, researchers reported that having multiple copies of a different gene called CCI3L1 also gives a measure of resistance. So are there other genes that might be at work? How can this information be used to develop better treatments or vaccines? Joining me now to talk about that finding and how it fits in with what we know about CCR5 are the two lead researchers. Dr. Sunil Ahuja is a professor of medicine, microbiology, and immunology at the University of Texas Health Science Center. He is also director of the VA HIV-AIDS Center there. He joins us from the studios of Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Thank you for being with us today, Dr. Ahuja.
Good afternoon. Thank you for being here.
Good afternoon to you. Also there with Dr. Ahuja at Texas Public Radio is U.S. Air Force Colonel and Medical Doctor Matthew Dolan. He's the director of the Defense Institute for Medical Operations at the Brooks City Base in San Antonio. Thank you for being with us today.
Glad to be here.
Let me begin with you. Why did you look at the... Tell us about this specific gene, the CCR5, and how it works and why you looked at it.
Well, CCR5, as you indicated, was earlier described as one of the important gateways for the entry of HIV, and that observation really was born to fruit by that observation you said, which is that when individuals have two defective copies of this, they don't express CCR5 on the cell surface, and that affords pretty much very high resistance to it. So that is somewhat forms like a lock, if you will, and for the entry of the virus, or a gateway. And then these keys, which are like the chemokines, if you will, which interact with this receptor. And some very seminal studies earlier done actually from some investigators back at Iron Diamond, like Dr. Kaup and all, had shown that individuals who are highly exposed to the virus but resist the virus, actually their cells make a large amount of these chemokines. And another seminal study by Dr. Gallo and his colleagues in Italy, in Zaguri, had shown that actually hemophiliacs who had received tainted blood, and some of these individuals, hemophiliacs, had resisted the virus, and their blood cells again produced a large amount of chemokines that interacted with CCR5. So CCR5 are these soluble immune molecules that interact with CCR5, and then the hypothesis would be that individuals who had low amounts or who innately produced low amounts of these chemokines would be more susceptible to virus. And then other investigators, including Dr. Gallo and others, had shown that individuals who produced low amounts of or higher amounts of chemokines were had a good clinical outcome. So it was a logical extension of this work to ask whether certain chemokines could influence the susceptibility to HIV and AIDS. And we took a genetic approach to examine this problem. And the chemokine that we focused on is actually IRS called CCL3L1. And it's a very potent ligand for CCR5, or an immune molecule that interacts. It's one of the most potent ones of them. And by virtue of that, it actually has fairly significant anti-HIV properties in vivo, so like natural anti-HIV substance in the body.
All right, Professor, that was Suna Hugo's take on it. What's your response?
Well, this is a classical example of junk science. If you pour in a lot of money in a project, you find takers who come up with sophisticated explanation like this that sound extremely scientific and are complete garbage, in my opinion, and I tell you why. We all have the same genes here on this planet. I mean, we humans, as a race.
Right.
We have yet to find a gene that you have and I don't, and the other way around. But some of those genes are mutated, and that again is random. There's a certain percentage of hemophiliacs or sickle cell anemia or something in the population.
Right.
And this is quite random. I mean, no, there's a little bit racial biases in one way or another, but within a race at least it's totally random. So what are we saying, or what these smart doctors are saying here is, there are mutations that make you susceptible to AIDS, and in others that are resistant, there's no such mutations and therefore they are resistant. Now look at the result in America. Guess where these mutations must be? 70% of them in male homosexuals and 30% of them in intravenous drug users. And the male or female mainstream American Republican, I assume, and democratic even, heterosexual population doesn't have these genes. Hasn't God made a great decision to get let these genes be with those chunkies and homos, and we get rid of them slowly, and maybe a little bit more in Africa than I wish.
Right.
Isn't that great? God, in His wisdom, has distributed these genes exactly as the majority would like to see it, isn't it?
It shouldn't be too shocking, huh? Now, next, Hugo goes into the variation in the doses of the genes and the low copy of this in your genes. So let's see what Hugo has to say and move on from there. Check it.
Maybe he's on the phone. Let's have a look. Huh?
The way we examined this then was to basically ask if individuals who had variations in the gene that produces this chemokine called CCL3L1, whether that influenced their risk for HIV/AIDS susceptibility. And as you pointed out, most of us have two copies for most genes, or two alleles. In this case, this gene is actually a different kind of variation, and most investigators look at changes in what we call the DNA alphabet soup of the A, C, T, or G, the nucleotides that we call them. In this case, this is a different kind of variation where we're talking about differences in the dosage of a gene. And so CCL3L1 gene copy numbers vary among individuals. And we screened large populations of individuals and found that individuals who possess low copy numbers of this gene are have a higher predisposition to acquiring infection, and once infected, their rates of progression.
Let me see if I can translate for the lay people. This is a large mouthful of stuff that very few of us understood, but I'll see if I can translate it for you. In other words, if you have a large amount of CC3L1, it floods the receptors and blocks HIV from getting in. Would that, in a few words, sum up what you've said? If you have the genes, you have a lot of copies of this gene, you make a lot of this this chemokine, as you called it, it goes into the lock. It keeps that lock shut and prevents the AIDS virus from entering the cell. So what you want to do is maybe make something that can help flood the gene, the receptors for HIV?
That would be a simple way of putting it. That would be correct. I mean, it would be like trying to find an analogous version that could do the same thing that the natural version does.
I want to bring on now someone who's studying the genetic differences, not in humans, but our closest relatives, some of our closest.
All right.
Well, it's in essence more of the same. He says himself, they use a mouse full of stuff that needs to be translated into the same idea that people who get AIDS are mutants compared to others. But mutants are randomly distributed, not just homosexuals and junkies. They would be everywhere. They would be in Walnut Creek and in the Castro, and they would be in Lafayette or in San Ramon, not only in the Castro or in the hemophilia wards or in the junkie courts.
Right.
That's just absurd. There's no precedent for this, and what they're saying is just, you know, that's what I call junk science. You give enough money, you look for a gene and publish that, and nobody could ask even this the most fundamental question that we just posed. If that were controlling susceptibility to AIDS via the virus, we should have AIDS in all groups of the population, and we definitely don't in America and in Europe. And this is a huge sample. We have 280 or 300 million Americans and 400 or 500 million Europeans, where AIDS is exclusively restricted to these risk groups, male homosexuals and junkies. It's different in Africa, but there we have no risk group at all. There the correlation is very good with malnutrition. The doctors don't get AIDS either in Africa. Isn't that interesting? And the scientists visiting there from the CDC and the NIH regularly to catch new strains of viruses never come home with AIDS. With lots of viruses, they come home, but never with AIDS.
Aren't they
lucky, huh?
Now, this wouldn't be the first time that an infectious disease, quote-unquote, was misdiagnosed, or something supposedly. Like, wasn't there what was called the Smone disease that was considered to be an infectious agent in Japan, but it turned out not to be infectious? Could you explain that?
It was diarrhea, and in fact it led to blindness in the end. The first symptoms are diarrhea. It's a drug that is used against infections, enteric infections. Enterovioform was the trade name. It's a Swiss company, CIBA, made it. You could buy it in Mexico. You could even buy it here for prescriptions. And if you use it for a short time, it's okay. But if you use it long term, then it causes blindness and eye diseases. And so they thought that was, and of course, it was again said to be a virus related to polio. And for years, it was treated this way. Until finally somebody, a review was made that this is in fact a drug, an iatrogenic disease, which is a fancy word for meaning a disease induced by doctors who prescribe drugs.
So in other words, what you're saying is that for years, the Smone disease was thought to have been an infectious agent. Now my understanding, they quarantined people. They said, look, people in clusters are getting this disease, like families.
Yeah.
So they said it must be infectious.
Yeah.
And then it turned out that it was something that was prescribed to people, you know, a pill that was prescribed to people. And it went under different names because it was called different names by this company. So it wasn't just, in other words, like if people were getting sick by using Tylenol, but say Tylenol had 8 different names. So people just didn't connect the dots and thought that what was being prescribed to them, which was actually making them sick, was actually, they thought was an infectious disease. Is that not correct?
That's exactly right. That's how it, I mean, there's another big precedent in America, like, but the precursor of the CDC, the Public Health Service, for decades insisted in the early part of the last century that pelaka was an infectious disease transmitted by unhygienic conditions of the farm workers in the south.
Now, let's
that never seemed to infect healthcare workers and doctors either.
Right.
Until Goldberger, a medical doctor who moved down there and studied it, figured out that this was a problem with nutrition. They were eating corn, and that was what their normal diet was, and they only ate that one. And they never had any meat, so they had vitamin B deficiencies, which caused pelaka, and thousands and ten thousands died from it until he finally prevailed and said they have to eat hamburgers once a week, and then it was over.
Now, you know, you mentioned prostitutes before.
Yeah.
Since prostitutes are a high risk factor for all other STDs, what is their percentage of the risk factor for AIDS? In other words, if it's an infectious disease, meaning HIV, AIDS, it should be just as optimistic as the other STDs that are out there. So how does that correlate? Do they have AIDS at the same percentage that they have these other STDs?
Virtually nothing. Nothing. The only ones who get some AIDS are the prostitutes who are also intravenous drug users or junkies.
So once again, you're talking about what people are doing in a micro-environmental way.
That's right. Yeah.
Using particular drugs within their own particular system. That has a detrimental effect.
That's
on
the why they don't study them anymore and don't mention them anymore. Like our friends who talk about the CCR5 and chemokines and all these fancy genes.
Right.
that are missing in prostitutes too, or present, whatever they are. For some reason, it's their business, sex. Not a bad job in many ways, but
right.
No, probably not every day. But who knows? But they should be the first ones, or should have been. They were predicted to be one of the first ones, victims of the AIDS epidemic. And we don't hear a word about them anymore because nothing happened. And the sex tourists, likewise, they're going to Southeast Asia, they're going to Africa, they're going to Puerto Rico, and they come home with nice pictures and whatever they have for souvenirs, but never with AIDS.
Well, let's talk about another group, that's teens. You know, AIDS is often always talked about as being a high risk for teens, America's 26 million teens. Now, according to the CDC, new AIDS cases among U.S. teenagers in 1998 only totaled 293, and that was a drop from the previous year of 403. Now, the sum total for AIDS among Americans, teenagers between the age of 13 and 19 for the entire period known as the AIDS epidemic is 3,432 cases. In Canada, just two new cases of teenage AIDS were reported in 1997, while the same year, Canadian teenagers accounted for half of all 4,442 new infections of gonorrhea. So, break that down as far as the teen aspect and why we're not seeing it more prevalent in teens, if the hypothesis is the infectious
well,
disease.
Well, the data speak for themselves. It rules out the sexual transmission argument. Except they have yet another excuse for that one. They say it takes so long. You know, you pick it up at 18 and it takes 10 years to cause a disease. But in the meantime, they don't mention that argument either anymore because the epidemic is now, the so-called epidemic is now 20 years old. We should see now that the teenagers plus 10 years old, namely the twins, dying at the expected proportions. And that doesn't happen either. So they don't mention that so much anymore.
Right, right.
The sexual transmission, not the teen. Or they say they all use condoms, of course.
Right, right. All right, next, let's hear
from another excerpt. And here we have them talking about what may be an example of not connecting the dots. There's a UK report that has come out saying that a single change on the gene protects the rhesus monkeys from getting AIDS. Now, this is John Story who talks about it. Let's examine this latest new one from the Orthodoxy, and I'll have you take it from there. Check this out.
Relatives, the rhesus monkeys, some of them, they're completely immune from HIV infection. Wow, that's amazing. Why should they be immune? They're very close to us genetically. What is there about their genes that makes them immune and not us? Well, researchers in the UK this week report that just a single gene, a single change in one gene, and it's a gene shared by humans and monkeys, a single change protects rhesus monkeys from the HIV virus. And we humans, that gene protects against other retro infections, like retrovirus infections, but not HIV. So joining me now to talk more about this work is Jonathan Stoy. He's the head of the Division of Virology at the Medical Research Council of the National Institute for Medical Research in the UK. He joined us by phone from London. Thanks for staying up late for it.
It's good to be talking to you.
Tell us about the rhesus monkey is naturally immune from HIV infection?
That's right. There have been a number of attempts over the past few years to develop good models for AIDS, and primates were one possible model. And it was found that HIV grows very poorly in most primates if you try and introduce it. And from studies like this, it became clear that there was a gene in monkeys that was very good at blocking the infection of HIV. And studies by Joe Sadrowski last year showed that this was a gene called TRIM5, that you have the monkey TRIM5 gene. It works fine to block HIV replication. The human gene does not. What we've been doing is to examine the difference between the two, and what we can show is that a single amino acid difference between the monkey and human genes gives this difference in behavior of the gene. So the monkey genes are completely resistant, or the monkeys are resistant, we are not.
One single amino acid can do it.
That's what we're saying.
All right, Professor.
Thanks God for that amino acid. For the monkeys. Thanks. But what my colleague here doesn't mention is that the chimpanzees, our closest relatives, share that amino acid difference with us from the rhesus monkeys. They have not the amino acid that, according to him, protects rhesus monkeys against HIV. They have the same receptors as we do. And yet, we have injected hundreds of them now. They're all sitting in farms, eating bananas and waiting for AIDS to come. And many of them were infected even before the virus was isolated with blood from AIDS patients. And not even one single one of them has ever developed AIDS. They're susceptible to the virus. They make the same antibodies as we do. The only difference is they don't take AZT and they don't take poppers and nitride inhalants or cocaine. That seems to me where we should be looking, rather than a single amino acid in rhesus monkeys.
Right.
If you want to get a bit closer to the answer. Here.
Now, the AIDS orthodoxy basically has various testing procedures for testing for the HIV antibodies. The Western blot, the EPA, IFA, and the ELISA, ELISA. They tell us that these are 99.5% accurate, but it appears that they're not really testing per se for the HIV antibodies, but certain proteins, and that at times certain other diseases and symptoms can spark off what is called a false positive. In other words, factors known to cause false positive HIV antibody test results are things like naturally occurring antibodies, leprosy, tuberculosis, renal kidney failure, flu vaccination, herpes simplex 1 and 2, hepatitis B vaccination, organ transplantation, and on and on. Could you explain what is going on with this whole antibody testing procedure and exactly what they're testing for and how there seems to be so much confusion and cross-pollinization?
Well, see, the antibody testing, I would like to say, before I even give you the specific answer, is only relevant if we had proof that HIV causes AIDS. And even then, it's a questionable test. We don't get sick from antibodies against the virus. In fact, that's the only way to protect against the viral disease, is antibody against the virus. That's what's called a natural or an artificial vaccine. So if we had antibodies, we should have actually no problems whatsoever with that virus we have antibodies against. So antibody testing is in fact, even if HIV were the cause of AIDS, only a certificate of vaccination. What we should test for, if we were concerned about this virus causing a disease, is the virus. But since we can never find it, we have now sort of tacitly agreed to look at the antidote, the natural antidote against the virus, instead of the virus, and sell it as if that were a threat. This puts immunology and virology on its head. Every doctor, every orthodox doctor will tell you for every other virus we know and every other microbe we know, if you have antibody, not to worry about it now. Now you're safe. You don't have to worry about yellow fever if you have a vaccine or an antibody or about salmonella or whatever. You have the best protection we can offer. And now to your technical question. Even as such as antibody tests are inherently variable. They're not totally reliable. And I'm not even blaming the AIDS establishment for that now. That's a general characteristic of antibody tests. They can detect an antibody that's very high with great certainty, but the lower the titer is, the less antibody is around, the less accurate the test gets.
Right.
Because the antibody doesn't look at the gestalt, at the whole thing. It looks at little rasters. It works a bit like you send a picture per email. You don't send the whole the painting. You send little dots, digits, and the antibodies work like that. They don't see the whole virus. They see so-called epitopes. These are little rasters. And those epitopes are not unique. They're very small. They're not unique. They're black and white dots, you know, that are shared with other viruses, with microbes. So the lower the titer gets, the more you get cross-reaction with other things. So I'm not faulting them for that. What is really worse is, why do you even look at antibodies against the virus as a prognosis for disease? It should be the opposite conclusion. You should say, oh, we have to not worry about that virus. And before that, before we even start doing that, we should be sure, as you asked earlier, is that virus even causing the disease? Have we met cross postulates? And we have.
Right. But see, that's where they do seem to be at fault, because they're going backwards, it seems, almost. And then, based off of that, they start to prescribe you deadly DNA terminating drugs like DDI, AZT, so on and so forth. But next, Ira Flato asked John Stoy, the possibility of changing the amino acid in human and introducing modifying genes into one system as a save all for this HIV AIDS situation. So let's check out what they have to say.
Is it possible in down the road someplace to change that amino acid in people so that we would have that immunity?
I think thoughts of germline gene therapy are somewhat beyond the scope of this program. But we could
No, the thoughts are not beyond the scope of the program. The completion of it, I think.
What we could contemplate, however, is somatic cell gene therapy, trying to introduce a gene of the modified kind back into human lymphocytes and trying to develop within HIV-infected individuals populations of resistant cells which would block progression to frank AIDS.
Could it be that there are humans that might have this mutation, we simply just don't know about them?
We've never looked. I think, however, it's unlikely. We've looked at... We're doing phylogenetic studies of the evolution of this gene in a variety of different monkeys and apes. Others have done similar studies. It looks as though within the great apes, within our closest relatives, they've all changed. Compared to the recent monkeys. So it's unlikely, it's possible, but it's unlikely that humans will prove to have resistance markers of one of these locus.
All right, so what do you do with this information that you've discovered? How can we make practical use out of it?
We're making a number of proposals, one of which is that we might think about gene therapy, trying to introduce a resistant form of the human gene into our cells. Another would be to try to develop drugs that might alter the behavior of the current human gene and make it now recognize HIV.
Very interesting. I want to thank you for taking time to talk with us.
Hi, Professor.
Well, very interesting colleagues. Now, from the people who cannot figure out how the virus causes AIDS after it's neutralized by antibodies, treat people who have a virus that's neutralized by antibodies not making DNA with the DNA chain terminated to slow down the virus, and yet have never, ever cured one single AIDS patient. Now they're promising us to improve our genes by their gene therapy to make it get more like monkeys. I can't wait for this to happen. That is junk science at its best.
Well, it seems to be spiraling around, and this, unfortunately, where we get is that, presently, there's more than $50 million mm-hmm. of taxpayers' money goes to this whole war on AIDS battle that, is siphoned off from the U.S. taxpayers. Mm-hmm. And recently it's come out that children in New York's poorest district were forced to be part of an HIV trial, mainly black kids. A BBC News report had also came out and said that HIV-positive children, some only a few months old, are enrolled in toxic experiments without the consent of guardians or relatives. The city's administration of children's services, ACS, does not even require a court order to place HIV kids, meaning kids who have the antibodies of HIV, with foster parents or in children's homes where they can continue to give experimental drugs. One kid named Jamie, who was in the incarceration children's center, said, quote, "I did not want to take my medication, but if you want to get out of there, you have to do what they say." He then told a story of how one of his friends who refused to take the drug, quote, "My friend Daniel didn't like to take his medicine and he got a tube in his stomach." Now it turns out that some of these kids have actually died, and some of the cases they weren't even bothering to see if they even had HIV, so they not even going through the pretext of it all. And who's behind a lot of this? The companies that supply drugs for trials are amongst the world's largest, including GlaxoSmithKline.
Oh, God.
Now, once again, this seems like the corporations are involved in bastardizing the basic civility of how basic treatment is supposed to go on. Kids are being turned into guinea pigs, and it seems like this move for corporate funds is bastardizing scientific integrity, all within the sphere of giant corporations like GlaxoSmithKline. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, that's beyond my scientific expertise, but I mean, if this is true, and I heard about it as well, I read about it as well, I think it would be something for George Bush to invade or to declare a preemptive war, isn't it? I mean, that this is happening in our country,
right?
That's supposed to be the freest of all countries and the home of human rights.
Well, boy, George may be actually leading the charge, because as beholden as he is to his particular corporate masters, and I say that also in part because the U.S. Or the White House has been defending the FDA following news about a number of drugs like Cilibrex, Vioxx, and all of these drugs that were able to skip through basically very easily and be put on the market and have ended up hammering people's hearts into smithereens and stuff. So in essence, what I'm saying is that it seems that much of the debate over the issue of HIV, AIDS, and other issues that are going on, like if you look at some of the work by Samuel Epstein on
cancer,
and how a lot of household products are causing these cancers and stuff, and how one out of every three females gets cancer in America, and one out of every two males now gets cancer in this country, that obviously there's something else going on. This is not, you can't just throw this up to bad genes by a human population, where 60 years ago this wasn't taking place on this level. So, you know, our grandparents had super genes, and suddenly a generation and a half later we're collapsing. So I put this out as a in part a question and in part a statement to how do you feel about the way corporations and the state are playing a role into scientific inquiry and integrity in today's field in America?
Well, I feel, of course, terrible about this, but I think the blame goes even primarily to my colleagues, to the scientists, who have their ego and their careers to defend, and they go apparently everywhere in order to achieve that goal, and they are the ones who actually prepare the or have developed the ideology that allows this kind of thing to happen. The companies, I think, are only secondarily responsible.
Right,
they want to make business. They want to sell something. If there's an ideology that says HIV is worse than anything, you can even give it to kids if they don't want to, and take the kids away from their parents and force them to take these drugs, then, of course, you will find companies that exploit that. And what do and the other group that is highly responsible are Europeans, who control the radios and the journals. Most of them, like your friend Ira, they conform with the scientists in order to keep their jobs and have the breaking the mainstream news. And the government, well, the government isn't any more sophisticated than we two are probably together. They hear the mainstream news and they follow the mainstream in order to be reelected. I think they are misled too. I'm even excusing the government. I think the real responsibles are the scientists making their careers and having just one idea or one thing to sell, one investment, self-interest to defend, and the journalists and the reporters who have exactly the same agenda. They want the hot thing from the mainstream and want to write for the best journals and get the best contracts.
Well, I do think I see this as part of a corporate state issue, because you have a situation where the government has been laying out the platform for the corporations to basically take over the media system. It's a corporate state situation where you have ABC be able to be owned by Disney, who also owns, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that is a way of empowering the corporate base, which is in alignment with the particular state. In other words, during Clinton's administration, we've seen a situation where Clinton relaxed the Telecommunications Act, which allowed the corporations to own more and more radio and TV stations. So this allowed them to expand and have undue influence. So the same way that we've seen that happen within the media system is the same way we've seen that happen in other elements within our particular society. I do think that businesses do have also an ideology, and that's profit. Profit over people. And that helps condition those people in a business corporate society like we have into place over periods of time. In other words, if there was no Gallo, I believe there would be they would find a Gallo in the same way that they have found one scientist after another to basically go under their game plan concerning global warming and other issues and stuff. When scientists come out with the issue concerning what is happening to the global biosphere, they just thump them out and move another in. But next, to show you the circular aspect of what's going on with these guys, on an Ira Flatow show, they discuss how this virus, it seems it has a mind of its own, continues to outsmart the scientists all the time, which of course helps feed into what we were just talking about, the corporate machine. Check it out.
It's been, how many years now? 1981, AIDS has been around for...
Right, 23 years.
23 years that we know
of. 23
since
we've known of it. Realistically, probably at least, you know, at least 10 before that it was probably circulating, and maybe even a little more.
And it outsmarts us all the time.
It does seem that way. It does seem that way. However, I think it's important to sort of, you know, not only see what we need to do, but how far we've come in terms of drug therapy. I mean, I was an intern in the mid-80s in the Bronx in the midst of the epidemic. And at that point in this country, it was a death sentence. And young people were coming in and they were dying before our eyes. Now my colleagues at the Aaron Diamond, Marty Markowitz and Dr. Ho, my boss, who treat in seropositive people with drugs and who've worked out how to use the antiretrovirals, people are getting one or two pills a day and leading normal lives and really are dealing with a chronic disease, not a death sentence. Mm-hmm. And that change is it's not to be underestimated. And Matt, I mean, I know you've seen more of it than I have. I mean, it's nothing short of a miracle. The problem is, for one, the drugs are not perfect. And for two, 95% of the epidemic is in the developing world, where most people don't have access to the drugs.
Well, there are people critics have said, you should have gone after the vaccine first instead of the treatment.
Yes.
Then we might be further along with the rest of the world.
Absolutely. And I have to tell you that if asked, I might say the same thing. I'm obviously biased. I'm an immunologist and a vaccinologist. But, one of the things that we have to do in developing a vaccine is work on what's called distributive justice, which means getting the drugs that we do have to the people who need them the best way we can as we're working on a vaccine. But I think one of the good news is one of the places that we've moved forward is there was a lot of, not a lot of attention paid to vaccines even 10 years ago. And that's changed in the last decade. And certainly there's been a major response by the NIH, a major response by the Gates Foundation. A lot of people who previously, Dr. Ho, my boss, was engaged in working on drugs, and now in the last 5 years, he's turned his attention to vaccines. I think that's all very optimistic.
All right, Professor. They're very optimistic, it turns out, after all these years of failure.
Cautiously optimistic, as they call it, almost every year. It's cautiously optimistic. And they have never cured even one single patient. That's a big background against which to be optimistic. You couldn't be worse off. You got to be optimistic there. Well, how can she call herself a vaccinologist and not notice that all AIDS patients in America have antibody against the virus, and so much that they can't isolate the virus? I wonder who is more intelligent here, the virus or the virologist? She keeps saying the virus has outsmarted us all the time. I can see why. Now.
Well, something else seems to be going on also, because not too long ago, an analysis found that in the United States, in 2003, there was an account for the first sales of new medications was up 60%. That was those with active ingredients never previously marketed. Now, that's compared with 3%. In the early 1980s. Now, in addition, the number of adverse reactions to medications in the United States increased by 145% between 1994 and 2003, although the number of prescriptions filled increased by only 59%. So it seems that a lot of this is being fueled once again by profit over human worth, profit over scientific integrity, profit over much integrity as a species at all. I would like to thank you for stopping by. And
once more, I would like to add one last thing here.
Yeah.
The profit motive might be a good denominator, but it really isn't the strongest among scientists that I know, and even among many reporters. Writers. Their ego and their career investments are bigger, the biggest organs they show.
But do you think
even more than their profit?
But do you think that the scientists are the strongest? Because in other words, we live in a particular society where you can have certain spheres of influence and power, but in a market-based society, that power at this present time works and operates within the corporate structure. Yeah. If one looks at how
but look at the scientists who they are. They're household words now. They're highly decorated. They get awards. They have the best positions. They have huge grants. They have postdocs. They get invited to meetings. They have companies that pay salaries what they earn at universities. Now, if they were wrong, if their virus AIDS hypothesis were wrong, they would lose all of this. They would lose their graduate students, they would suffer dearly in their careers, they would lose their grants, they would lose their awards. In fact, they would have probably to stand class action suits for helping people die with DNA chain terminators on the basis of the hypothesis they have yet to prove 21 years after they advanced it. They cannot prove it.
And part of the reason why they don't have to prove it is because of the power that they rest within the corporate state. In other words, it's not just them.
No.
It's the corporations that are behind them, the corporate media that puts out a particular line.
Yeah.
The corporations that smother out dissenting views, as you personally well know, and your own experience attest to that. What happens to us authentic, honest scientists who do try to use honest scientific inquiry and forms of looking at this in a scientific, professional way. Well, in this particular climate, that is not particularly acceptable. And unfortunately, those who have a lot of influence and power on saying what is and is not acceptable or not are those who are not scientists per se. They are more or less like passenger viruses. They're along for the ride. And those who dissent against that particular view are thrown off the plane without a parachute, and they bring aboard the next line of obedient scientists that will go along.
And without a day in court.
Yeah, without a day in court. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Professor, and I'll see you soon. All right. Well, that's just going to about wrap it up for Slade tonight. It's clear that as long as we depend on the corporate state and its corporate-backed scientists who are wound up within the corporate infrastructure, we're going to be left into a ball of confusion. Until the next time, Slave.
Teacher.